It's a joy once again to be able to deliver another lecture, a second lecture. And this one is called Reformed Confessions 1500 to 1800, which the title sounds a little bit like a snoozer, so let's hope not. I mean, let's try to make this a little bit more interesting than that title. It's just a framework, if you will, for looking at this important idea. In that, as Reformed Christians, we put our heritage in the 16th century, particularly in the confessions of the 16th century. So it's important for us to look at least very broadly as to how did all of these confessions come about. But what I want to do in particular is I want to address this issue, this particular topic, from a very specific question. It was 19th century Scottish Presbyterian theologian by the name of Horatius Bonar. Perhaps you've seen some of his hymns in the Trinity Hymnal. He says, "It may be questioned whether the church gained anything by the exchange of the Reformation standards for those of the 17th century. The scholastic mold in which the latter are cast is somewhat trenched upon the ease and breadth which mark the former. And the skillful metaphysics employed at Westminster in giving lawyer-like precision to each statement have imparted a local and temporary aspect to the new which did not belong to the more ancient standards." Now, I think that when I first read this statement, I was a little bit surprised because, you know, one of the things that typically go hand in hand is confessionalism and Scottish theology. I mean, you just those two things are like, you know, ice cream and chocolate syrup. I mean, you think that these things are supposed to go together. But I have no idea why I said ice cream and chocolate syrup. Just first thing that came to mind. But I was surprised to find that Horatius Bonar was expressing a degree of dissatisfaction with the Westminster standards, saying that they were a lot more rigid, at least in his mind, in comparison with the 16th century Reformed confessions. Now, this is something that was, I think, a bit of a trend in 19th century Scottish theology, but it continued in the 20th century. You find this same kind of criticism coming from Scottish theologian T.F. Torrance or Thomas Torrance. You find the same criticism in more conservative circles from John Murray, where at certain points John Murray expressed his own personal preference for the earlier Reformation confessions. But in particular, you also find this same criticism most recently given by John Frame in his History of Western Philosophy and Theology, where he talks about the Reformed confessions of the 16th century being more personal and existential, is the word that he uses. Perhaps he has the Heidelberg Catechism in mind. What is your only hope in life and in death? And he says that the 17th century theology, particularly with regard to the Westminster standards, is more detailed, more argumentative, and quote-unquote more academically respectable. In other words, he says, well, they wanted to find greater respectability among the universities and the academics, so it's more academically respectable. And there's a sense in which whatever accusations are hurtled against the Westminster standards kind of also get stuck to the Second London Confession because of so many overlapping areas of agreement. But what I want to do is I want to argue the opposite case, and I want to say that the 17th century confessions, particularly we would say the Westminster standards, and by connection, you know, the Savoy Declaration, the Second London Confession, that these confessions of the post-Reformation period have an organic and necessary link to the confessions of the 16th century. That they do not represent a devolution of theology, devolving of theology, where theology kind of started going downhill, but rather it's the necessary logical step in the development of confessions of faith, and in particular of Reformed confessions of faith. Now, to be clear, they are certainly not identical. The confessions of the 16th and 17th centuries have some differences. But the differences don't arise because of a declension or perversion, but because of local issues, and controversies. As I said in the last lecture, as darkness rises, light to meet it. In other words, as controversies arise, it requires greater specificity, greater degrees of precision. There were also church and political concerns that drove them. There were the varied receptions of older traditions, new responses to late philosophical developments, as well as even specific educational concerns. You know, and we'll look at each one of these ideas. And so what I want to do is I want to break our survey up into looking at first the Reformation, which goes from 1500 roughly to 1565 with the closing of the Council of Trent. And then we want to look at early Orthodoxy, which goes from 1565 to 1640. Then High Orthodoxy, which goes from 1640 to 1700. And then Late Orthodoxy, which goes to 1700 to 1780, roughly. Which my original lecture title I was given was to 1800. But I figure, what's 20 years between friends, right? So that gets us close enough. Anyway, again, in short, the Canons of Dort, the Westminster Standards, the Savoy Declaration, and the Second London Confession do not involve or do not represent a perversion of Reformation theology, but is a confessional edifice that rests organically upon the foundation of these Reformation-era confessions. So let's look first at the Reformation, roughly 1500 to 1565, in that during this period of history, there were two major concerns for the church. And at this point, we can say that large in part, though we might want to qualify, that there is really only still one church. It's only one church. And that one of the chief concerns was repelling Turkish armies. Islamic armies were threatening some of the major cities of Western Europe. It's an increasing problem. But also, one of the things that they wanted to do in the 1530s was address the religious tensions that existed. You know, Martin Luther had posted his 95 Theses in 1517. And so they wanted to make sure that they understood what was going on, who believed what, because things were a little bit unclear. They were a little bit chaotic. And so Charles V called an imperial diet where he solicited confessions of faith. So Luther sent Melanchthon with the Augsburg Confession, which had largely been written by Melanchthon, though certainly approved by Luther. Martin Bucer had written, along with several other theologians, the Tetrapolitan Confession. It was written in the city of Strasbourg. And then Zwingli submitted his own personal confession of faith called Account of Faith. And then Roman Catholic officials submitted a refutation of the Augsburg Confession, which then elicited Philip Melanchthon's response of what he calls the apology for the Augsburg Confession. Now, apology in our day may have the connotation of being sorry for something. It comes from the Greek word apologia, which means defense. So this was a defense of the Augsburg. Now, broadly speaking, and we can only speak in the most superficial terms here because we don't have the time to look at the documents individually, is first of all, we want to say that these documents were written in relatively short periods of time. And they focused particularly on issues that divided Protestants from Roman Catholics. So that if you look at these various Reformation, we can call them Reformation Confessions 1.0. These are the very first confessions of the Reformation. None of them really had any formal statements on the doctrine of Scripture. None of them really had any formal statements on the doctrine of Scripture. Augsburg, the Tetrapolitan, or Zwingli don't really talk about the doctrine of Scripture that much. The Augsburg Confession begins with God, then moves on to sin, Christology, justification, the office of the ministry, and then new obedience. I think that if you look at the Augsburg Confession, while it does talk about some of these other things, one of the chief topics of concern was the doctrine of justification. Hence, the focus on sin, Christ, justification, and new obedience. Okay, so in other words, front and center is the chief topic of debate between Rome and the Protestant reformers. The Tetrapolitan Confession likewise talks about sermons, because the nature of preaching was a topic of debate. The doctrine of the Trinity and Christology, because I think one of the chief concerns among the Protestants was to show that they weren't sectarians, they weren't heretics, they embraced the historic teaching of the church, hence this statement on the doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of justification, and the doctrine of good works. In other words, pressing concerns shaped these documents. They were not really full-orbed statements of faith. And so I think this is one of the more important observations that we want to make about Confessions 1.0, is that they were written in short order, they addressed particularly topics of controversy, and they were not full-orbed statements of faith. Now, the same kind of pattern unfolds with what we can say is the second wave, or Reformed Confessions 2.0, in the wake of the Council of Trent. Because you get the French Confession of 1559, the Second Helvetic Confession of 1566, the Belgic Confession in 1563, as well as the Heidelberg Catechism in 1563. All of these are written right around the conclusion of the Council of Trent. This is an important historic observation. Why? Well, because the Council of Trent obviously produced the Tridentine Statements of Doctrine. It was a meeting that lasted over 20 years. Now, just to be clear, it wasn't one long 20-year meeting. That would be, I'm sure they would have earned lots of points out of purgatory for that one. No, it was a meeting that just was held, series of meetings held over a period of 20 years. But after each session, they would produce the statements, condemnations, anathemas, which meant that, well, the Protestants needed to respond in kind, because all of a sudden there are new developments, new claims, new counterarguments. And so the Council of Trent addressed faith. The Council of Trent addressed Scripture and tradition, original sin, justification and good works, and sacraments, so that all of these topics had been addressed. And even though Trent closed in 1565, really, the Second Helvetic Confession is the only confession that comes at the end of the Reformation that could fully address everything that Trent said. But all of the rest of these confessions had to address what Trent had discussed and the counterarguments that they had raised. So, for example, in the Confessions 1.0, you don't have any formal statement on the doctrine of Scripture. But now here comes the Council of Trent. And the Council of Trent, quote, has decided that a written list of the sacred books should be included in this decree in case a doubt should occur to anyone as to which are the books which are accepted by this council. So they listed all 66 books of the canon. These are the authoritative books to which we profess. But they also listed the books of the Apocrypha. You know, as a kid, I always wondered, man, why don't we have Bell and the Dragon? That sounds really cool. And why don't we have Maccabees? You know, I when we were trying to decide on names for our children, I told my wife, what about Maccabees? That would be really cool. It means the hammer. I think, yeah, that would be awesome. The other name, it's like everybody always wants to name their son, you know, Owen or Calvin. I said, come on, let's go big, honey. Let's name our son Wolfgang Musculus Fesco. That would be a name to remember. Didn't go very far. My absolute favorite name of any theologian, bar none, the Dutch Reformed theologian of the 17th century, no joke, Taco van Haho. He is my favorite theologian of all time, just because of his name. I can't wait to meet Taco in heaven. I digress. But Trent lists the books of the Bible. So what do you think the Reformed confessions start to do in response? They begin to get more detailed. And in particular, you get the French confession, the Belgic confession, the Second Helvetic confession. They all give lists of the books of Scripture so that they can respond to the developments and the arguments of the Council of Trent to say, yes, we believe that these 66 books and these 66 books only are those books that hold authority in the church. We reject the claims of Rome regarding the authoritative nature of the Apocrypha. And so now the French confession has three articles on Scripture and includes a list of canonical books. The Belgic has six articles on Scripture. The Second Helvetic has one chapter with nine articles on Scripture. Now we can look at this development in one of two ways. We can say, oh look, this is a devolution. This is a declension of the more existential and personal statements of Confessions 1.0. You can potentially say that. But when you begin to look closely at the facts, when you look at what history surrounds it, I think it's really irresponsible to say that it's a declension of the theology of the Reformation. You could maybe say that, well, it's not as existential when you take into account that Zwingli's confession of faith was a personal confession of faith. I believe this or that. Okay, well, then it's less personal. But that's because these are more corporately oriented. In other words, it's not written by one individual, but rather it's written by a group of individuals. I think we would say that these confessions do not introduce new doctrine, but rather they engage new criticisms. Moreover, you have a larger group of theologians now contributing. I'm sure that this statement in no way characterizes Reformed Baptists, but among Presbyterians, they say all you need is you get three Presbyterians in a room and you get five opinions. I'm sure that has no bearing whatsoever upon Reformed Baptists. But I think that this is something that necessitates a greater degree of specificity in the confessional documents, because now with more people contributing to the discussion, you have more differences of opinion, which means that you have to get a little bit more specific at certain places, or perhaps maybe a little more vague. And so you have Calvin, Beza, Viret, for example, all contributing to writing the French Confession of 1559, but then the French National Synod takes this document and makes some changes to it to satisfy this group of ministers. It wasn't just Zwingli, for example, but rather an entire synod adopting a confession of faith. There was also, I think, there were greater educational needs because you have Confessions 1.0, the Augsburg talking about God, original sin, justification, office of ministry, and new obedience. But then I suspect you get students, theological students, as they're training this new generation of ministers who begin to ask questions. What about Scripture? What do we believe, given what the Council of Trent has had to say? What do we believe about faith? What do we believe about sanctification? What do we believe about the doctrine of Scripture? What do we believe about God? And so because of the educational needs, you get fuller orb statements in this 2.0 or Confessions 2.0, this second wave of confession. Now, I think in that respect, too, you also have the writing of new doctrinal works that kind of contribute to the conversation. I think everybody or most everybody is familiar with Calvin's Institutes, but there were other works that were also contributing. Philip Melanchthon in his Commonplaces, one of the most published and distributed works, not only among the Lutherans, but also among the Reformed. Heinrich Bullinger wrote his Decades, which were 50 doctrinal sermons that he covered basically the whole breadth of doctrine. You could say that it was really the first systematic theology. It antedated the final edition of Calvin's Institutes by 10 years. And that Bullinger's work was just as influential in many respects, I think, as Calvin's Institutes. In fact, in the Dutch churches, it was designated as a house book. In other words, when fathers wanted to do devotions with their families, they would open up Bullinger's sermons and they would read one of the sermons as a devotional for the family. If you've read some of these sermons, they're kind of long, so it would be a long devotional. Same thing, if you needed a sermon and the preacher was sick, they would break out Bullinger's sermons and read them from the pulpit. In addition to that, you had Wolfgang Musculus, Wolfgang the Muscle. He must have been a wrestler in part-time work. He too wrote commonplaces. In other words, basically a systematic theology. So you had these doctrinal works being written, contributing to the discussion, which then, I think, eventually bubble up to the surface in the second wave of confessions. The Council of Trent, in many areas, was very specific and used scholastic, that is, academic distinctions. I think in some circles, to be scholastic, that's almost like an insult. But it was Karl Barth, who I know, I probably shouldn't quote him. Make sure that lightning doesn't come down. But Karl Barth, who says the true test of theology, the false prophet fears the test of scholasticism. The false prophet fears the test of scholasticism because the scholastic theologians, which is another way of saying school-trained theologians, were very precise. There's no mistaking what the theologian meant. You pick up a copy of Francis Turretin's Institutes of Eclectic Theology. I know Calvin's institutes are good, but if I have to pick one set of institutes because I'm on a deserted island, I'm not sure why I'm there, but if I'm there, I'm taking Turretin with me. I love Turretin. I you know, maybe I'll have to do a t-shirt. Turretin is my homeboy. But Turretin is just razor sharp. Razor sharp. Scholastic distinctions are very careful qualifications. Now, the Council of Trent uses careful scholastic distinctions when it's talking about the doctrine of justification. What is the instrumental cause of our justification? According to Trent, it's baptism. Wrong. You know, we don't agree with that. What is the material cause? What is the material out of which, if you're talking about a statue, a material cause of a statue would be its stone. The instrumental cause of the statue would be the chisel. The efficient cause of a statue would be the sculptor. And the formal cause of the statue would be the plan. The final cause of the statue would be the purpose for which the statue was made. And so Trent uses these fine-tooth distinctions, these scholastic distinctions. Interestingly enough, the Reformed confessions, Reformed 2.0, or of the 17th century, Reformed 3.0, do not use those scholastic distinctions. So the accusation that Horatius Bonar says that they breathe the air of scholasticism, I think is kind of inaccurate. But what they do, these confessions, whether it's 1.0, 2.0, or 3.0, they do say that faith alone is how we are justified. So they're precise, but I think precise in a pastoral way. Now, at times, we will see this, for example, when we look at Westminster, there are, I think, the echoes of some academic distinctions. But even the Westminster divines were very careful to say, we do not want this to be a scholastic document, because this is ultimately a corporate confession of the church's faith, whether of the academic scholar all the way to the child in the pew. So this is the corporate faith of the church. We want these to be pastoral. We want these to be more easily understood. So I think Trent goes more scholastic than the Reformed confessions do. But ultimately, I think that with these examples, they illustrate the fact that Confessions 2.0, it wasn't the devolution of theology, the perversion of theology, but simply the response to the ongoing theological debates and the context in which they were writing these documents. Moreover, I think we can recognize the fact that confessionalism is not a static phenomenon, but rather the church was engaging in this ongoing discussion, particularly with Roman Catholics. Although we'll see shortly in a few minutes that there were also internal discussions about many of these things. So it's these ongoing discussions and debates and criticisms that contribute to greater detail, and I think blessedly, and we'll see why in a few minutes, greater precision. Now, going to early Orthodoxy, which is the period of 1565 roughly to 1640, right before the Westminster Confession is written. So 1640 back to 1565. During this time, there were a few confessions that were written. Most notably, the 39 Articles were adopted by the Church of England in 1571. It originally began life as the 42 Articles in 1553. And by a miracle, when they were adopted, they reduced the number of articles from 42 to 39. Not something you often see in the church. Documents shrinking. But Matthew Parker, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, revised them and drew upon a number of other confessions, even Lutheran confessions, to compose and to finalize the 39 Articles. So the 39 Articles are a post-Reformation era confession of faith, but written in the broader vein and tradition of Reformation theology. Now, shortly thereafter, in 1595, there was a controversy over the doctrine of predestination at Cambridge University. Two students there objected to the common Reformed doctrine of predestination. They objected to Calvin in particular. And so William Whitaker, one of the professors at Cambridge there, drew up 9 articles on the doctrine of election and created a document called the Lambeth Articles. Now, the Lambeth Articles, you can Google them, they're out there on the internet, they differ greatly from the 39 Articles regarding the level of detail. You look at what the 39 Articles have to say about predestination, and it's a very brief, warm, and pastoral statement on the doctrine. Whereas you look at the Lambeth Articles, and at first glance you might say, well, these sound very scholastic, very academic, very dry, very dusty at times, if you will. But once again, this is where I would say, take a look at the particular context in which these are written. The 39 Articles are written within the Church of England as a corporate confession of faith. The Lambeth Articles, by contrast, are written in a university setting by a professor of theology to respond to specific theological claims and criticisms against the Reformation doctrine of predestination. So keeping those different contexts in mind, I think explain why they are somewhat different. But the question that we would want to ask is does their formal difference constitute a perversion, or would we say that the Lambeth Articles simply illuminate, illustrate, and exposit what the 39 Articles teach about predestination? And I would argue it's the latter. It's simply a response to these doctrinal challenges. Now, the Lambeth Articles were never formally adopted. They are always viewed as something of an appendix because I think Queen Elizabeth at the time looked at them and wasn't quite fond of them, and so she kind of left them off to the side. Now, what would she have to do with any of this? Well, because remember, in England, in the Anglican Church, the Queen or the King is the head of the Church, and so Queen Elizabeth didn't want formally to adopt them. But when we come to 1615... we have the creation of what's called the Irish Articles, because there was an Episcopal but nevertheless Reformed church in Ireland, and they charged James Usher, who was eventually the Archbishop of the Church of Ireland, to create the Irish Articles. And the Irish Articles draw upon the 39 articles. And Archbishop Usher also drew upon the Lambeth articles and folded a number of statements from the Lambeth articles into the Irish articles. Now, why are we talking about the Irish articles other than because it occurs in this window from 1565 to 1640? Well, because, believe it or not, the Lambeth articles are one of the foundational documents for the Westminster Confession of Faith. At several points, in fact, the Westminster divines just lifted statements, whole and complete, straight out of the Irish articles and used them in the Westminster Confession of Faith. So what you begin to see in Confessions 3.0, in this third wave of confessions, is that they're drawing explicitly upon the earlier confessional tradition. They're drawing upon these earlier documents, the 39 articles, the Lambeth articles. Now, some people might say, well, okay, this is definitely much more detailed than some of these earlier confessions. Why didn't he stay with the less detailed statements of the 39 articles? Again, I think this is basically the fruit of the cycle of debate. You don't have these long, drawn-out, bitterly fought debates. And then when you finally tamp down the false teaching, then say, okay, let's toss out the doctrines and the confessions that we've written because that debate is complete. You know, think of the Christological debates in the early church when they say that Christ is not homoiousios, not of like substance, but is homoousios, is of the same substance. We finally can put the Arians out because we have defined the doctrine of Christ biblically and confessionally. Then you don't say, okay, we're done. We don't need that term anymore. You need those terms because you need to keep the false teaching at bay. You need the degree of specificity. You need the degree of accuracy and of precision. Because one of the things that false teachers always do is they fiddle with words. They will use biblical words in unbiblical ways. And so what the church has to do is explain by other terms what the Bible means by the various terms that they use. And so this is one of the things that explains this degree of specificity. I think famously, the Canons of Dort, the Synod of Dort, where we get the 5 points of Calvinism, I think some people look at that and think, well, good grief, why did they come up with these 5 points of Calvinism? Well, it's because Jacob Arminius and Simon Episcopius came up with the 5 points of their teaching. So the Reformed Church was responding to these 5 points of objection, to the 5-point remonstrance, the 5-point objection. And so this is where you get the 5 points of Calvinism. It's not that a bunch of Reformed theologians were sitting around going, hey man, what are you doing today? I don't know, you want to get together and write up 5 points of doctrine? Yeah, let's do it. Let's call some friends. It had nothing of the sort. It's just, again, darkness rises, light to meet it. And so, again, you find them responding because what happens is that Jacob Arminius wanted to change and loosen the terms of the Belgic Confession. And so the delegates to the Synod of Dort had to respond very specifically at points as to what constituted Orthodox teaching and what constituted a violation of it. It is this and not this. And this is why you see the statements affirming the doctrine of predestination and all of the related teachings to it, as well as the rejection of errors. We deny this, we deny this, we deny this. And even, for example, on the so-called dreaded doctrine of the limited atonement, they reach back into the Middle Ages to Peter Lombard, who was the author of one of the most used theological textbooks before Thomas Aquinas' Summa. And it was Peter Lombard, who was no advocate of the dreaded limited atonement, that said that the atonement of Christ was sufficient for all, but efficient only for those who are saved. So even on that controverted point, they just pull ancient teaching from the church and they restate it. As to why it is now the dreaded doctrine of a limited atonement or the scholastic doctrine of a limited atonement, I don't know. Now, what Dort does, which is a bit different than earlier theologians of the church, is they recognize that it is sufficient for all, but efficient only for the elect. In other words, they recognize, they coordinate atonement and election. But this is in response, again, to the Arminian teaching. And as we would argue, in consonant with the teaching of the Scriptures. Now, some might claim, no, the Irish Articles introduce a novel teaching. They introduce something that does not exist in the Reformation confessions. They introduce the doctrine of the covenant of works. That's new. Now, I always find this criticism really interesting to me, because I want to say, you can't have your cake and eat it too. I've tried. It doesn't work. In that, if with the 16th century reformers, we say that Scripture is the supreme authority in the doctrine and life of the church, then what are you supposed to do when you come to an exegetical conclusion that the covenant of works is a warranted doctrine? Do you leave it out of your confession? If you leave it out of your confession, then you're promoting a dead traditionalism. You refuse to bring your confession into alignment with the teaching of Scripture. Which means then that if you accuse them of being novel, then you're actually a proponent of a dead traditionalism. In other words, thus the 16th century has spoken, and no further can we go. But if, on the other hand, the Irish Articles say that no, the Scriptures are the supreme authority in the doctrine and life of the church, and it takes precedent over church tradition, then with the introduction of the covenant of works, it's the introduction of further refinement of biblical teaching, which is holding true to the principles of the Reformation, which, as I would argue, it is showing the organic link, staying true to the principles of the Reformation, staying true to the principles of Confessions 1.0 and 2.0. In other words, the Irish Articles do not represent a perversion of the 16th century confessions of faith, but rather, I think, an organic development of their teaching. I don't have time to go into the details because, oh, how much I would love to. I've written about 700 pages on the covenant of works, half of which is a history of the doctrine of the covenant of works. So we could talk for the rest of the day about the covenant of works. But my wife would say, John, you're monologuing again. Are you going to give me a chance to say anything? And I say, no, I'm not done yet. But blessedly, my wife is helpful in those ways, so I won't monologue on the covenant of works. But the covenant of works, I think, is ultimately just the label that 17th century theologians give to a number of teachings that are already substantively present even in the Reformation. Calvin, for example, when he talks about sacraments, he says a sacrament is the sign of a covenant. And what does he identify the tree of life as? A sacrament. Which I think irresistibly leads us to the conclusion that God and Adam are in covenant. Calvin teaches that the Mosaic covenant is a legal covenant and that it is distinct from the evangelical covenant, which is where William Perkins picks this up and develops the language of the legal covenant, the evangelical covenant, the covenant of works, the covenant of grace. Calvin teaches natural law, the law of God inscribed upon the heart at Adam's creation, which is a significant portion and chunk of the covenant of works. So I think that all of the pieces of the puzzle are there in the 16th century for the covenant of works. It's just that theologians finally gathered them all together in one place and said, we need to label this and we need to formally include it in our confession. All right, so we have Confessions 1.0. You know, Zwingli, the Augsburg Confession. We have Confessions 2.0, that second wave, the French Confession, the Belgic Confession, the Second Helvetic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism. Then we have Confessions 3.0, which would be the Canons of Dort, the 39 Articles, the Irish Articles, the Lambeth Articles, which brings us now, if you will, to Confessions 4.0, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Savoy Declaration, the Second London Confession. These are confessions that appear in High Orthodoxy, which is 1640 to 1700. I think in this respect, we can say that the Westminster Confession of Faith stands out as the most influential confession of the Reformed tradition, because the Congregationalists picked it up, because the Reformed Baptists picked it up and modified it accordingly to their convictions about polity and baptism and several other areas. But nevertheless, the lion's share of all three of those documents have much in common. Now, critics have targeted the Westminster strand as a deviation from Reformation theology. Again, T.F. Torrance, the great confession of Calvinist scholasticism, which brought into quasi-creedal form the core of the systemized doctrine of the great Reformed dogmaticians of the early post-Calvin era. That's a telling statement. He says that it is the creedal formula of the doctrine of the post-Calvin era. In other words, this is not the theology of John Calvin. He lists a bunch of theologians that have informed these documents, you know, Westminster, Savoy, and Second London, Beza, Zanke, Piscator, Buchanus, Wolebius, Keckerman, Polanus, Ursanus, Ames, Wallius, but not Calvin. He doesn't mention Calvin. And so he pits the Westminster Confession against Calvin. It supposedly doesn't exhibit the same freshness of freedom or the joy, he says, of the Scots Confession. And so you read the Scots Confession and you say, well, okay, there is a degree of warmth there. Read the Westminster Confession. Well, I'd still say there's some warmth there, but there's certainly some greater degree of specificity. Why is this the case? And this is where I want to say, I cannot believe that well-educated theologians make such irresponsible claims. Because let's compare the Scots Confession, be it ever so briefly, against the Westminster Confession of Faith. The Scots Confession was written by four men in 4 days. Four men in 4 days. The Scottish Church said to John Knox, you and three other men need to write a confession for the Scottish Church. You've got 4 days. Go. I'd be like, yeah, sorry. I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. Pick one of the other confessions and just use that. Westminster Confession is written over 3 years by over 100 pastors and theologians. Do you think that the documents will be slightly different? Get 100 men into a room, and I promise you there are going to be disagreements. Promise you there's going to be disagreements. And this is why it's a little bit more precise in some places, in part to handle these disagreements. We're going to talk about some of these disagreements in the fourth lecture. But I love the Westminster Confession, not only because of how specific it is in certain places, but also how wondrously vague it is in other places on purpose. But we have to take some of these things into account. Moreover, When 80 years, you have to account for the Scots Confession is in 1560. The Westminster Confession starts in 1643. More than 80 years have passed by. What was going on in this country 80 years ago? Was it the same? Would you expect that 80 years ago, the church might have been talking about questions about gender identity? I don't think so. I don't see any historical evidence of that discussion. So just in terms of the last 80 years, new questions come up. New debates come up. We're asking different questions about the Bible. And I think the same is said of the Westminster Confession of Faith in comparison with the Irish Articles, or in comparison especially to the Scots Confession. Now, in that respect, the Westminster Confession in some places just takes phrases right out of the Irish Articles and repeats what the Irish Articles has to say about predestination. You could say that, okay, I see the traces of scholasticism there, because in chapter 3 of the Westminster Confession, it talks about secondary causes. God does not do violence to the will of creatures, but in fact, through his decree, upholds secondary causes. You say, is that really fit for a confession of faith? And I'd say, yeah, absolutely. Do you know why? It's because they're preserving these two important teachings of divine sovereignty and human responsibility. They didn't want people to think, we can do whatever we want because we are sovereign, as 17th century Socinians taught, or now as open theists taught or teach. I remember reading a book by Clark Pinnock where he talked about, and it was edited and he was a contributor, where it said that, you know, Mary wanting to go to school prays to God, and God tells her in prayer that she should major in finance, not knowing that there will be a financial collapse in 5 years and that this would not be the best advice. So you're thinking, okay, well, we don't want to say that because that's obviously very heterodox, contrary to the teaching of the scriptures. So we want to affirm divine sovereignty, but on the other hand, we don't want to deny human responsibility either. So that when the scriptures in Acts chapter 2, when Peter says, this occurred by the divine plan and foreknowledge of God, you men took by lawless hands. In other words, God was sovereign, but you are still responsible. So the Westminster Confession takes all of these things and puts them together and says, no, secondary causes, that is, human responsibility, is a reality. God does not do violence to the will of the creature. He doesn't force people to sin. So you can say, oh, sure, that's very specific. But I think it's very specific in a very necessary and pastoral way, both for truth as for the sake of piety as well. I think you can find the same concerns, for example, in the Westminster Confession's treatment of the doctrine of sanctification, because antinomianism, lawlessness, you know, lawless living was a serious concern for the Westminster Assembly. You know, there was a letter that was sent to the Westminster Assembly that said that antinomianism was running rampant throughout London, and there was great concern for the thousands of souls that might perish because of this false teaching. And so you read the chapter 19 on the law, and it's very specific as to the abiding nature of the law. You read the chapter on sanctification, it's very specific on all of these things. Why? To preserve the truth in the face of the falsehood of antinomian teaching. Not because there was a desire to be overly precise or legalistic. When we come at last to late orthodoxy, there are not a whole lot of confessions coming around at this point. I think that the confessional dust had somewhat settled. This is not to say that confessional activity completely ceased, but at least in terms of the big, you know, the big confessions of faith had been written. In Confessions 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, and 4.0, we can say that in late orthodoxy, you get Confession 4.1. And you get this with a document that was written by Francis Turretin and Johannes Heidegger. They wrote what is called the Formula Consensus Helvetica, the Swiss Formula of Agreement, the Swiss Formula of Agreement. And it was written in 1675. There were a number of concerns facing the Swiss church over hypothetical universalism, the idea that God had a conditional decree that dispensed the atonement of Christ universally, but hypothetically to all. There was debate about the doctrine of mediate imputation instead of immediate, that God just simply assigns Adam's guilt. One theologian said that no, God gives this imputation through procreation, hence mediate imputation. There was a rejection of the authority of the Masoretic vowel points. In other words, the original Hebrew text has no vowels in it because the Jews didn't use them, didn't need them. In fact, I once asked, a friend of mine went to Israel and asked, when do you guys drop out the vowel point? Because in seminary, we read the Hebrew text with all the vowel points, and here we are grown men reading the vowels and the whole text there. And he says, oh, we stop using vowels in kindergarten. That made us feel like such men. Oh, great, we're not even at kindergarten level with the Hebrew text. But in the 10th century, the 7th century AD, you had Jewish scholars who said, hey, we better put some vowels in here because we're kind of forgetting what the text says, so we need to put in the vowel points. And so Turretin and others said, some are rejecting these vowel points. We believe that the vowel points are inspired by God, even though they were added almost 1,000 years after the Hebrew Old Testament original. They also wanted to reject a threefold doctrine of the covenants. In other words, saying that the Mosaic covenant was not of the covenant of works or the covenant of grace, that it was a third type of covenant. They wanted to reject that teaching. And so they drew up their document in 1675, primarily written by Francis Turretin, and it was quickly adopted by the Swiss cantons. But despite its rapid adoption, some refused to sign it because they said, no, this is drawing the confines and the boundaries of orthodoxy to too narrow. It was too narrow. No creed, for example, had ever codified the inspired nature or the supposed inspired nature of the Hebrew vowel points. No document had ever made that claim. And no document since has made that claim. No Reformation confession claims the vowel points. The Westminster Confession, the Savoy, and the Second London don't make that claim. And I think because at certain points they did try to narrow the gate too closely, too small, and it was very narrow, I think this is one of the reasons why people rejected it. Moreover, and we'll talk about this in the next lecture, this is in the wake of the 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War, as well as the English Civil War. I will expand upon this comment in the next lecture, but theology and warfare went hand in hand, unfortunately, in the 17th century. So people were not interested in creating more narrowly constricted confessions because I think they feared more violence. More violence. And so within 7 years of the adoption of the Formula Consensus, Lausanne only required their ministers to subscribe insofar as they believed it was biblical. In other words, they gave them a way out. From 1675 to 1700, one-third of all ministerial candidates were allowed to opt out and say, we don't agree with it. Okay, fine, you don't have to sign it. And then the elector Frederick William of Brandenburg pressured the Swiss churches to rescind the formula because with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, in other words, France had declared that Protestants could legitimately worship, but then with the revocation of this edict, all of a sudden the Roman Catholic Church persecuted the French church, and the Protestants fled to Switzerland, among many other places. And with the exiles came all of their so-called peculiar views, And so the king of the area said, can you please exercise a little bit more toleration towards these French theologians? And this confession of yours is kind of unwelcoming. And so the Swiss church has said, it's okay, they don't have to profess it. And then by 1706, Francis Turretin's sons convinced Geneva to abandon the Formula Consensus Helvetica, so it lasted some 30 years. And then the last city to use it was Zurich, but they set it aside in 1741. So it was a very mediocre reception. And I think it was very mediocre because at certain points, say, for example, on the doctrine of the covenants, where the Westminster Confession of Faith has a greater degree of liberty, they drew the gates much more narrowly. On the Masoretic vowel points, no confession says anything about it, yet this confession draws the gates again very narrowly, making unprecedented and novel claims. So as much as Turretin is my homeboy, I love Francis Turretin, I think the Formula Consensus was a confession too far. In other words, it tried to draw the gates of orthodoxy too narrowly. And it didn't allow for a lot of flexibility in a number of these areas where the earlier confessions had given significant flexibility. And its limited reception, I think, is evidence of the fact that it didn't even last 100 years. And even then, for what it did last, it was very spottily employed. So all of this is to say is that I think that there's substantive agreement between the confessions of the Reformation and post-Reformation eras, with the Formula Consensus notwithstanding, and that the differences are largely due to occasional or personal versus very deliberate, precise corporate statements of faith. It's a difference between fewer participants and more participants. It's a difference between new doctrinal controversies requiring greater precision and clarity. It's a question of difference between 1.0 confession versus a 4.0 confession, all surrounding around educational needs as they're training new ministers and they want to get the ministers trained in the full sweep of doctrinal truth. So it is not at all a question of devolution, declension, or perversion, but rather I think it is legitimate organic growth of the church responding to these different doctrinal challenges, as well as responding to internal needs of the church for greater precision, as well as responding to the teaching of the scriptures and respecting their primary authority in the life and teaching of the church, and thus bringing their confessional teaching into alignment with the scriptures. So far from perversion, I think that our confessions, the Second London and Westminster, represent the very best of the Reformation, and we need not fear perversion, declension, or devolution.